Welcome, everybody. Today, we're very happy to have Jan de Boer from the University of Amsterdam, and he will talk about quantum gravity and statistical physics. Please keep your microphones muted and unmute if you want to ask questions. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for the invitation. It's always fun to give a talk at the Perimeter Institute. Not as much fun as doing it in person, but still. And in this, I hope this can be a very informal talk, because I'd like to hear opinions and get some feedback if possible. So please interrupt at any time. I try to also keep it somewhat conceptual and not make it too technical, just to emphasize some of the main points I would like to make. And this talk is mostly based on four papers that were all four written together with Alex Bellin. Two were written also with my PhD student, Diego Liska. One also included Tarek Anous, and another one included Julian Sonder and Pranjal Nayak from Geneva. So to introduce everything, semi-classical gravity, which is a theory we like a lot and use a lot, especially in AGCFT, turns out to be a very peculiar theory, and it's different from standard low-energy effective field theory. For example, I'm mostly having AGCFT in mind, and one can debate whether or not these things generalize to more general spacetimes, but obviously the rules of the game are less precise than AGCFT. It's a very peculiar theory because we can use purely semi-classical gravitational methods to compute black hole entropy. That does not require any quantum gravitational knowledge. You can just, say, compute the Euclidean partition function of some cigar geometry for any value of the temperature. And in particular, you can get in AGCFT, you can extract just from a gravitational computation the high temperature partition function of the theory. More generally, you can compute the partition function of a field theory in semi-classical gravity using AGCFT by just taking the boundary to be some Euclidean manifold. If you want, you can stick some operators in it. And you can just use the usual rules of AGCFT to compute these sort of correlation functions of operators on various manifolds. It has also fairly recently been shown that the so-called Pace curve, I won't discuss it anymore in the rest, so I'm just mentioning it, can also be obtained from semi-classical gravitational methods. Although it's not purely within the semi-classical regime, I think, if you're honest, because to properly do this computation, you have to couple your system to some external field theory. And I think to do this properly, you need to have an infinite precise control over this external system. So it's not something that's computed purely in a semi-classical theory, but it's computed in a semi-classical theory coupled to a theory where you think you have exact control. Also in the famous example of JT gravity, things like spectral correlations have been computed using semi-classical gravitational methods. And one of the puzzles that came up in all these computations, which is a very general statement, is that as soon as you have a spacetime that has more than one boundary, the semi-classical computation for such a spacetime, if those two boundaries gives some number, and those numbers seem to spoil factorization of partition functions. Because if you take one particular quantum field theory and you compute this partition function on one manifold, and you take another, the same quantum field theory and the same manifold again, and you ask what is the partition function of these two theories together, it's just the product of the individual partition functions. They're just two completely independent field theories that live on these manifolds. But if you follow literally AGCFT rules, if you have two boundaries, there can be connected geometries that connect the two. And those could be, you know, saddle point solutions, so actual solutions of the field equations. You could even imagine off-shell solutions of that type, and then clearly there's many, but also very hard to control. But anyway, it's very weird that apparently in Euclidean quantum gravity, you need to include these connected geometries that seem to spoil the factorization of partition functions, and which has led to the suggestion that perhaps at a very fundamental level, Quantum gravitational theories can never be dual to a single quantum mechanical system, but they also need to involve some sort of disorder average. Because if you disorder average, you can get correlations between partition functions from the disorder averaging, because the disorder introduces correlations between the two theories. Now, although you can compute all these things in a semi-classical theory, so let's, for example, look at this first case of black hole entropy. You can compute a high temperature partition function, but you can never do that exactly. It's always an approximate computation. For example, if you have a system with a discrete spectrum, the exact partition function would simply be given by the exact density of states, which is a sum of delta functions, times E minus beta E. But what you find if you do this gravitational computation is you find a coarse-grained version of this computation. You never see the individual delta functions, but you see some coarse-grained version of it. So it's an approximation to the exact result. So although you do get in your semi-classical gravitational computation, you do get some information about the high energy behavior of the theory, it's not exact information. It's coarse-grained high energy information. Now, you could say it's a dream in quantum gravity is to go beyond the coarse graining and to actually find these individual energy eigenvalues and to fully and exactly solve the theory. And it's a very interesting question whether that is even in principle possible. If you have a finite N system, like finite N, N equals 4, super Yang-Mills theory, you could in principle try to solve it exactly for some finite value of N. Maybe that's doable. At least you could do it numerically with arbitrary accuracy, I suppose, on a supercomputer or whatever. But in the large N limit, it seems extremely unlikely that such an analytic solution can be found. Because as far as we know, these theories are most likely chaotic. And I think that in a large N chaotic theory, it's pretty much impossible to exactly compute these energy eigenvalues. Now, so the structure of the kind of field theories that are dual to gravity and age CFT, or these weird strongly coupled CFTs, where roughly the spectrum has two pieces. It has a low-lying piece, and that part of the spectrum is integrable, that is under good technical control. And then at high energies, the spectrum appears to be chaotic. I don't think anyone has proven that the spectrum is chaotic in a rigorous mathematical sense, but there's a lot of indication that that part of the spectrum is really chaotic. And therefore, we should ask ourselves the question of whether we should even try to solve the theory in that sector exactly and whether that's a useful enterprise. Maybe if you're like a meta observer, maybe you could try to do that, but suppose you're part of this system yourself. Suppose you are part of this theory. Is there any hope that you'll be able to resolve these chaotic energy eigenvalues? If you yourself are a low energy observer that's part of the system, I think not. So maybe these features that we see in semi-classical gravity, they are just telling us that we will never be able to fully solve the theory and that the best we can do is to try to find some coarse-grained features of the chaotic part of the spectrum, but it's hopeless to try to solve it exactly. This is disappointing sort of string theory perspective, because in string theory, we always thought we were going to solve quantum gravity exactly. And once you would always keep on trying, but I want to question whether that is ultimately the right perspective that one should have. Now, the main claim that I want to make is that the theory that we call semi-classical gravity is a theory that describes the statistics of the chaotic sector of the theory. And if you think of these, this chaotic part of the spectrum as some sort of statistical distribution, because it looks pretty random from the outside. So for example, it could be well approximated by random matrix theory. There's some general lore that in general chaotic systems, the spectrum starts to behave like that of a random matrix. The main claim is that semi-classical gravity is the theory of the statistics of this chaotic sector. So it can probe coarse-grained higher moments of all the relevant probability and statistical distributions but it will never be able to resolve individual values. In particular, it cannot distinguish average versus non-average theories as long as the averaging that you do does not change the moments of the statistical distribution. And as I was discussing a little bit before, you can ask whether this is, can we just not do it in practice, or is it a question of we cannot even do this in principle? And the details of this main claim depend a little bit on what you mean by semi-classical gravity and whether you think what should be included in that theory or not. But the general gist of the statement is what I just said. Now, to just give you some sort of cartoon version of what could be going on, suppose you take an operator A, and suppose the operator A is the average of the first n digits of pi. Now, the digits of pi, they are pretty random. As far as we know, they are a pretty random, randomly sampled from the number 0 through 9. It's a very specific sequence. It's not a statistical distribution. It's a very specific sequence. It's 1, 4, 1, 5, 9, 2, 6, 5, etc. So it's a very specific sequence. But if you take the average of the first n digits and you divide by n and you compute its coarse-grained expectation value, you get 4.5. which is the average of 0 through 9. And so if you say, if this was like your semi-classical gravitational observable, and these digits were sort of a cartoon version of the chaotic part of the spectrum, then we would find that the expectation value of A is roughly 4.5. And it would not tell us anything about the individual digits of pi, but it would tell us that the average value is 4.5. Pi might also not be the best example ever, because I don't think you can call, well, I'm not sure even how to, maybe this is like a very deep and difficult issue in math, I think, how to actually prove that numbers are random. I don't know exactly how you do that. But it's not a very complex set of numbers, because the Kolmogorov definition of complexity says that a sequence of numbers, the complexity is given by the length of the shortest computer program that produces the numbers. In this case, you can write a super short computer program that spits out all the decimals of pi. So it's not a very complex set of numbers, but they're pretty random. Now you could also ask, okay, let's now compute the expectation value of the difference of A minus 4.5 squared. So A is just a number, right? It's just some average. So the expectation value will be something, and you can compute that it's going to be 8.25 divided by n, approximately. And if you just for fun take pi, I did that earlier today just for fun, and you take the first 100,000 digits of pi and you compute the this quantity, it's 8.24, so it's pretty good. Now, these are very specific numbers. There's no averaging, there's no nothing going on. But this computation of A minus 4.5 squared, it looks a bit like the connected two-point correlator of A with itself. So you could think of A maybe as like the partition function of the theory. And then this computation would be something like the connected two-point function. And it scales like 8.25 divided by N. So what is this telling you? There is no real correlation between A and itself. They're just a bunch of numbers. However, if you coarse grain, which is what I'm doing here, then you do get an apparent sort of connected two-point function between A and itself. It scales in a certain way with N. And the number that stands there, this 8.25, has a meaning, because 8.25 is precisely the variance of the theory 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, around 4.5. So this computation, which is a bit like a wormhole-ish computation, because you're computing a connected two-point function. So you could imagine that there would be a gravitational computation that computes this for you through some wormhole, because it's connected. That number has a meaning. It gives you the variance of the distribution. So this is an example where, say, a semi-classical one-sided computation gives the approximate expectation value. And the connected two-point function gives you information about the variance of the distribution. In this case, it shows, it is evidence that the numbers of pi are really randomly drawn from 0 to 9, and that all digits appear basically with a 10% probability if you wait long enough. So gravity, the claim is gravity works a bit in a similar way. You have some very specific theory. It has some very specific set of numbers of energy eigenvalues. And what gravity computes is coarse-grained averages. But it can also, through wormhole-like computations and so on, and through other computations I will describe for you, it can also give you variances. And in principle, higher moments of this probability distribution. But if you wanted to resolve the individual first 100,000 digits, you may need to compute the first 100,000 moments of the probability distribution. And then eventually you will have so much information that you might be able to reconstruct those digits. That's clearly a ridiculous thing to do, because you should think of n as e to the s or so in the black hole context, and you never want to do e to the s measurements. Moreover, it's unlikely that if you do e to the s measurements, you would still be in the semi-classical regime. Now, let's be a bit more precise on how these types of phenomena might show up in the conformal field theory. So one nice place where you can see these features and you have technical control over them is if you look at the statistics of OPE coefficients. So we have some conformal field theory, it has fields, and you can compute the three-point function of these fields, C, I, J, K, and those are also the coefficients that appear in the operator product expansion. And if you know what the coefficients of the operator product expansion are, and you know the spectrum of the theory, then you have more or less everything that you need for a conformal field theory to compute correlators of local operators. Now, we again want to distinguish light and heavy operators, where in this picture of the spectrum, the light operators would sort of be in this integral part of the spectrum, and the heavy operators would be in the chaotic part of the spectrum. So C, light, 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 that's OPE coefficients of low dimension operators in the theory. And those are typically reliably computable in low energy effective field theory. They're just part of the low energy effective field theory if you include the corresponding light bulk fields, if you wish. But if you take an OPE coefficient that has a heavy index, which can have one, two, or three heavy indices, so those correspond to operators with a conformal dimension, which is much larger than the central charge or n squared or whatever, so you're basically in the black hole regime, then it's unlikely that you will ever be able to resolve the individual values of these OPE coefficients by the same logic that they sort of live in the chaotic part of the theory. And this led Alex and me to propose something called the OPE randomness hypothesis, which is basically the statement that to leading order, and I'll say more about what that means, but to leading order, these OPE coefficients behave like random objects. The light, light, heavy OPE coefficients, so where two operators have a small dimension and one operator has a large dimension, the claim is that roughly behaves like some smooth, slowly varying function of the energy of the heavy operator times a random number that has mean zero and variance one. So it's like a standard Gaussian noise type thing. Similarly, if you have two or three heavy indices, you have smoothly varying functions of the energies that multiply random objects with two or three indices. So RHH prime is like a random matrix, and RHH prime, H double prime is like a random matrix with three indices. But all these things are still sort of pseudo-random variables with mean zero and variance or the one. That's the idea. So this is not sort of conceptually entirely new, because there's a famous example of exactly such a statement, which is the eigenstate thermalization hypothesis, which I think Mark Sredniki introduced in the 90s at some point. And that's the following statement. So the eigenstate thermalization hypothesis is a statement that in a generic, chaotic, I think the intuition was mostly for quantum many-body systems, that if you take the inner product of a simple operator, which in CFT language would be an operator with a small conformal dimension, and you take the inner product between two exact energy eigenstates, I or J, The proposal was, it's a hypothesis, that it's approximately equal to a smoothly varying function of the average energy F times delta ij, so that's exactly diagonal in the energy eigenstates, plus another smoothly varying function g of the average energy and the difference of the energies, times E minus S as a function of the energy. Now, normally we write maybe the entropy as function of temperature, but if you have the entropy as a function of temperature, you can also write the entropy as a function of energy. So it's E minus S over 2 times an Rij, and this Rij, just as above, is something with mean 0 and variance 1. So it's like a random Gaussian variable. This was just a hypothesis. You can test it numerically in a chaotic. It seems to be a... It's not something that has been proven. It's also not clear that you can prove it. It's my internet. My computer complained that my internet is unstable. Am I still okay? Or
hey, we can hear you, but sometimes it makes some interferences. But you can continue, I think.
Let me quickly see. If it gets worse, let me know and I'll maybe switch to a different network.
Okay.
So this is ETH, and it's not something that you can prove. It's something that you could test in a given model. And in some sense, it does not contain genuine new information. Maybe you really would need to solve the theory exactly in order to test it precisely, which in a chaotic theory is probably very difficult, if not impossible. But what it does do for you is that this structure is able to correctly reproduce the thermal 1 and 2 point functions of the theory. The thermal 1 and 2 point functions of simple operators. And F and G contain all that information. So in some sense, you could say you could reverse engineer ETH. It's not something that you don't prove that it holds, but you could reverse engineer it if you simply know the finite temperature 1 and 2 point functions. So there's no genuine new information encoded in this particular expression. However, in a particular theory, you could test whether these Rijs are indeed sufficiently random or whether they have lots of correlations with themselves. So this is an example. And if we interpret ETH in conformal field theory language, then this G times E to the minus S over 2 times R is precisely a light, heavy, heavy OPE coefficient, because on the left-hand side is a 3-point function of an energy eigenstate, which is a heavy operator, a simple operator O, which is a light operator, and then J is another heavy operator. And on the right-hand side, there is this G times E minus S over 2R, and that's precisely a random variable times some function. So this is precisely the statement that C, light, heavy, heavy, is randomly distributed. So this particular OPE randomness hypothesis includes ETH for conformal field theories, but it's more general. Now, how do you check some of these statements, and how do you check whether the statistics of the CLLs is indeed approximately Gaussian and random, and can you say more about it? Well, how do you check all of these things? What are the methods that you can use to try to compute the statistics? Well, there's basically some techniques that you can try to use. So one important technical ingredient that you can use to try to check some of that is to use crossing symmetry. That's a very basic property of conformal field theory, and it was already used historically for the first time in this paper by Papadopoulou, Rieskov et al., where they, I think, was the first paper that actually made a statistical statement about OPE coefficients. So crossing symmetry, what you do is you go to a particular channel where on the left, the intermediate channel, so this L here is dominated by the identity operator. And then on the right, it turns out that in order for this identity to be true, and we know that this identity must be true, in order for this identity to be true, you can extract from the right-hand side, which contains a C light-light heavy OPE coefficient and another C light-light heavy OPE coefficient. These must have a particular statistics, because once you do the sum over H, and this right-hand side is dominated by heavy operators, and what you need is that once you do the entire sum on the right-hand side, you need to reproduce the right singularity in the cross-channel. Right? On the left, there is a singularity, and the size of the pole is determined by the conformal dimension of this light operator. And you need to reproduce that pole by that sum on the right-hand side. And if you demand that the pole on the left-hand side is correctly reproduced by the sum over heavy operators on the right-hand side, and you stick in, you know, the usual cross ratio expressions for four-point functions and so on, then you can extract the, in general theories, you can extract the expectation value of C light, light, heavy squared using crossing symmetry. In two dimensions, there's some extra technology available that is not available in higher dimensions. Which is that although conformal blocks of general correlators are usually unknown and very complicated, you can write down explicitly the linear functionals that relate different sums over conformal blocks. So in some sense, it's a conformal block version of the crossing equation above. So here you have a particular operator in this channel, and you can write it as a sum over this particular decomposition of the diagram. And the statement is that the conformal blocks on the left-hand side are equal to a sum over conformal blocks on the right-hand side with certain coefficients. And although the individual conformal blocks are unknown in general, the coefficients that appear are known. So it's kind of remarkable that you have an identity between unknown conformal blocks on the left and unknown conformal blocks on the right, but the coefficients that appear in that unknown in that equation are known. And there's a similar thing called a modular kernel, which also exists in two dimensions, where you basically decompose the torus one-point functions in two different ways. Again, there's two different bases of conformal blocks that in principle are difficult to write down, but the linear relation between them is known, although you don't know the individual blocks precisely. And those fusion and modular kernels, they are very close related to quantities in Liouville field theory, and they were first described by Ponsau and Techner, and then they were used effectively to extract OPE statistics first in this paper by Collier and Maloney and Maxfield and Sierre. Now, let me skip many, many technical details and just give you some results. So one result you can get is by looking at a k-point correlation function on the torus, if you want. So from an OPE diagram point of view, you have a bunch of external light operators, and in the loop, you have heavy operators running. So this diagram here on the left is given precisely by some power, depending on how many light operators you insert, some power of the light heavy OPE coefficient. And you can estimate what this is in terms of the entropy. So this is a bit sketchy. There's lots of other factors and coefficients, but you can estimate how it scales with the entropy, and this is the result that you get. So it decays with the entropy with some coefficient k minus 1. And this was first pointed out, I should say, in a paper by Foigny and Kuchia. Then you can do more complicated things, so that gets rather complicated. You can take this diagram on the left here, which my PhD student decided to call the skyline diagram, because it is vaguely reminiscent of a series of skyscrapers somewhere. So it's a skyline diagram, and depending on the number, and every line here is a heavy coefficient. So there's no external operators. So this is some diagram. It represents some configuration of OPE coefficients that all have heavy lines, and they're all contracted. So in two dimensions, this would be representing a higher genus Riemann surface. because every loop is a loop in the surface. And in two dimensions, you can, using many of these fusion and crossing kernels, you can also compute the asymptotic scale, and you get that C HHH to the power k scales with some funny power e to the minus 5k minus 4 divided by 4 times s. And you can do some other cases. You can do this particular diagram, the comb channel, which also has lots of heavy operators, and you get some scaling of CK HHH with some S. So all these things are higher point correlators or higher variances of the relevant probability distributions. For K equals 2, we just get like this Gaussian behavior. It's a two-point function. So the one-point function is always zero because these things have random signs. The two-point function is non-zero and gives the leading Gaussian behavior. But then these higher point functions, they give corrections to the Gaussian behavior. Like a three-point correlator, four-point connected correlator, and so on. So they, in some sense, give you the non-trivial higher moments of the relevant probability distribution. And the factors of S tell you how these higher moments scale with the entropy. They tell you what hierarchy in S there is between these higher moments and the leading Gaussian approximation. Then you can do some more diagrams that are more complicated, three diagrams. So it's fun to go in through some detail through the six-point light correlation function. You always have to choose the right kinematic arrangement so that in these intermediate channels, like here, here, and here, so that in the intermediate channels, you do, in fact, have heavy operators running. It's important to find some the right kinematical arrangement, and then you can get pretty precise estimates. And I wrote in blue again how it scales with the entropy. And then there's a much more complicated case that has a large number of internal lines and has some free parameters. That is a very general tree diagram with many external light operators and so on. That's not so important. It's just you can do the computation and you can figure out how this thing scales with S. Now, so you can do many of these computations. They're all interesting and they use a combination of crossing symmetry and fusion and modular kernels and so on. What's the general lesson? Well, the general lesson is, first of all, that these connected higher point functions are suppressed. So there is a hierarchy between all these correlation functions of these OPE coefficients. And if you take like the 6-point connected correlator to the power 1/6, it scales, it's much less than once when you take the 4-point connected correlator to the power 1/4. So if you convert all these numbers, for example, this one here, if you convert this into how an individual object behaves, then you find that as you go to higher point connected correlators, they have less impact on the behavior of an individual C. So it's really a Gaussian approximation with a hierarchy of corrections that get gradually smaller as you go to higher connected correlators. So that's the general pattern that one seems to emerge. It's also interesting to notice that these results apply in any conformal field theory. There was never an assumption that the theory was chaotic anywhere. So what does this have to do with chaotic theories? Well, the idea is that even in a free boson, these results apply. However, the amount of coarse graining that you need to do is probably humongous before these results apply. So I did not tell you everything that we're computing here are somehow coarse-grained averages. And I did the G window for the root approximation. I think in the chaotic theory, you think that if you average, say, over like 1,000 level spacings or something like that, then maybe it's already a very good approximation. But it's hard to prove anything like that. Whereas if you're in like free fermions or bosons, these results, the amount of coarse grain that you need to do is probably large.
Sorry, Jan, there is a problem with your connection, I think. Can you hear me?
Yeah, let me switch to something, some other network. Okay. Let's see how this works.
Okay. Can you maybe repeat a little bit what you were saying the last 3 minutes, because there were many interruptions?
Yeah, sorry for the... Yeah, so the general lesson seems to be that there is this hierarchy between all these correlators. And I think the last 2 or 3 minutes, I was mostly saying that these results, the methods that one uses apply in any conformal field theory, and the theory does not have to be chaotic. It applies even in a free boson or a free fermion theory. You don't need chaos for these results to hold. So where does chaos come in? Well, that comes in the amount of coarse graining that you need to do in order for these results to be valid. So although it's hard to make a very precise mathematical statement, one believes that in a chaotic theory where the level spacing is roughly E minus S in a generic chaotic theory, if the density of states is S, you believe that these results start to be good approximations if you coarse grain of an energy interval that is maybe 1,000 times E minus S or 10,000 times E minus S, but that it's a very, very tiny energy window that you need to average over in order to get these results to hold. But in an integrable theory, like a free boson theory or a free fermion theory, you believe that these results also hold that you need to average over a much larger window, probably a window of order unity, you know, 10 units of energy or 100 or whatever.
Can I ask a question about this?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I guess, is there like some sort of intermediate regime sort of which sits between a chaotic spectrum and like that of, say, a free boson? So where, for example, you have a completely random spectrum and not effects like level repulsion and so on. What, like, would you still expect that you have to average over like a larger window? And so that really like very small windows are specific to chaotic CFTs, or... I don't know, is there a way of telling this apart?
Yeah, I don't have, it's a very interesting question. If there is a sharp diagnostic, something that you can actually compute to precisely estimate these windows. And maybe a way to do that. But I am not quite sure what the best strategy would be to do that. So you can, in many cases, you can improve on these kinds of theorems using the so-called Tauberian theorems and so on, where you are more precise about the light spectrum of the theory. And maybe there's a way to connect the behavior of the light spectrum to the size of the energy window. Because it's a unique feature of these chaotic theories is that the low-lying spectrum is very sparse. And maybe there's a way to put a bound on this averaging window by examining the low-lying spectrum and whether or not it grows with the central charge. And maybe there's a way to make a technical condition there. And then these intermediate theories would precisely be theories where you don't have this very sparse spectrum at low dimensions. You don't also have the rapid growth that you have in, say, N-free bosons, but something in between. And it would be interesting to see if you can make that connection more precise. That would be the best place, I think, to look.
I see. Thanks.
Yes. So you can ask whether there's other ways to get similar qualitative behavior. And it turns out that very crude features that you get here can also be obtained from so-called microcanonical unitary averages. And you can also get it from a so-called sigma model for chaos, which was developed by Altnot and Sonner, which uses symmetry breaking and Goldstone boson-like thinking to write down a universal sigma model for chaotic theories. As long as those theories have an ergodic regime, as that's an assumption, and if they have an ergodic regime, then you can write a universal chaotic, sort of a universal sigma model that describes the lay-time behavior of these theories. And if you apply that technology to computations of the type that I described, you get similar, in a few examples that we checked, you get a similar scaling of the entropy. It's still not clear, it's unknown whether strongly coupled conformal field theories are technically ergodic in that sense. I think that has not been proven. I think there's some evidence for it, but it has not been proven, I think. I'm also not sure that if it's chaotic that we, for example, whether strongly coupled conformal field theories have random matrix universality at high energy, I think is also something that one might believe to be true, but has not been rigorously established as far as I know. So all the time describing suggests that these OPE coefficients can be obtained from some sort of generating functional. It's a bit like Feynman diagrams, where you have some generating functional in terms of, say, source J, and that all these connected correlators of OPE coefficients are obtained by just differentiating this thing with respect to J and then putting J equals zero, just like you do in perturbation theory for Feynman diagrams. That's what it all suggests. You can put all the information that I had before, you can squeeze it into an expression of this type. That can be done. It's still an interesting, different open question is whether that is the full general answer or whether more complicated structures are needed to capture all the semi-classical gravitational information. For example, all the computations that I showed above, they are single-sided computations. Just take a single CFT, and you do computations in the CFT, and you estimate statistics of OPE coefficients. It never used a wormhole-like configuration or anything like that. It was one-sided information only that gave all the statistics that I described. Now, it's possible, but I don't have a compelling reason to believe either way. It's possible that this is enough information and that wormholes will never give new information, but just give things that are consistent with the structure. I'll explain what I mean by that in a minute. It's also possible that if you look at connected wormhole type configurations, that you get new types of correlations between OPE coefficients of things that live on one boundary and things that live on the other boundary from gravity. And that those need to be included in these generating functionals. That would be genuine semi-classical gravity input, because there's no CFT computation you can do this computation. The only known computation to find correlators between left and right theories a priori is by using gravity, using a wormhole type configuration that connects the two. Because purely in a CFT with all the techniques that crossing symmetry and blah, 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 none of those give an a priori prediction. Well, they give a prediction, but we don't know whether it's correct. So if you believe, if you take this function, and if I take all the information that I got from one-sided field theory computations that use crossing symmetry and all these kernels and so on, if you take all that information and you stick it into a generating functional like this, you can now make wormhole predictions. And you can test whether those predictions are correct or whether they're wrong. And if they're wrong, that does not mean that the framework is wrong. It just means that this partition function Z needs to be augmented with wormhole specific information, which was just not accessible in the CFT to begin with. So that would be genuine new gravitational information beyond the realm of field theory. Let me describe briefly how you predict wormholes. So these wormholes, they have to do with these disconnected correlators. So suppose you take a CHHH, CHHH, where you contract all these indices together. So this index is the same as that one is the same as that one, and that one is the same as that one. So maybe at the level of a little diagram, it's just some sort of diagram like this, HHH. So suppose you take this correlator, and it looks a bit like a genus 2 partition function in one theory times a genus 2 partition function in the second theory. And we're looking at a connected correlator of this type. Now, I have my generating function also. I have statistics of the Cs, and it looks a bit like propagators and vertices, because it all came from this generating functional, which is very similar to what you do in perturbation theory. Now, the first leading disconnected piece that you can write down is just given by, it's just the obvious disconnected piece, and it's just given by the leading propagator that you get from this generating functional. It's just a propagator. So these red lines are these Gaussian propagators that we computed. So we know what they are, we know how large they are. And that is just corresponding in gravity to a disconnected computation. So just two gravitational bulks that end on two disconnected boundaries. But then if you just follow your nose and you use this generating functional that you got from one-sided computations and you just literally apply it to this particular computation, there's two other Wick contractions, two other propagator contractions that you can write down, which is the other two ones that I wrote. And these are predictions for connected correlators based on single-sided computations. Because I got this propagator from a one-sided computation, but once I have this propagator, I get this prediction for the connected correlator with two boundaries. And it uses only one-sided information. And so you can explicitly compute this third and fourth line here, this one and this one, you can explicitly compute those. And you can compare whether the numbers that you get agree with a gravitational computation for a corresponding candidate wormhole. So this way you make a wormhole prediction based on one-sided computations and based on this statistical thinking. And in this case, you can actually find this wormhole. It exists. It's a thing found by Maldacena Mauss back in 2004. And if you compute the gravitational contribution from this wormhole, it agrees with this prediction from perturbation theory. So this shows you that there seems to be some self-consistency here.
Sorry, can I ask a question? I might have gotten lost in sort of what you exactly did there. So if I understood correctly, you're just assuming you have two CFTs and then you sort of by fiat, you say, well, why don't we try to sort of like use the statistics of OP coefficients we found before to now like correlate the two copies somehow? Is that?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Is there something I could do to the CFT? Like, so say I give you two CFTs and I ask you, well, do something to it such that this would actually be the result. I mean, what would be sort of like an exact computation one could sort of do at the CFT level?
Well, the other way in which you can get these connected things is by disorder averaging of some sort.
Right, right.
So if you could invent a disorder average, so this statistics of these OPE coefficients, it's an approximate coarse grain statement. It only is true if you average over sufficiently wide energy windows and so on, right? It's an approximate statement, just like an ETH, it's this random matrix, it's an approximate statement. If you can invent an averaging over CFTs that makes it into an exact statement, so suppose you can introduce in a condensed matter system some disorder parameters so that if you average over the disorder parameters, this Rij that appears in ETH becomes a proper random matrix. Not pseudo-random, but random. Then these statements hold exactly in those average terms. And this computation would be exact. But you would need to invent a notion of disorder average that makes the approximate statistical statements that I'm making into exact statistical statements so that these C's become parts of actual probability distributions. They're not probability distributions here, they're actual numbers, but the coarse-grained features of those numbers are approximated by a probability distribution. If you average to make that an exact statement, then you're in business and all these things are exactly true.
Okay, yeah, so... Okay, yeah, great, thanks.
Now, suppose that there would be disagreement here between this green gravitational computation and these two Wick contractions. You could also always introduce another fourth order vertex, just yet another vertex, which could be fourth order, and try to fix the problem. Because we have only looked at second order vertices, but clearly third and fourth order vertices, well, third order vertices do not exist for CHHH, but there could be a fourth order vertex. So in principle, there could be something that contracts that and that and that simultaneously, just like in perturbation theory and finer diagrams. And that fourth order vertex could correct for any mistake that you make. But then the wormhole would predict an interesting fourth order vertex. that would not be predicted from the one-sided computations also predict fourth order vertices. In fact, I gave you, in these cases, I do get actual predictions for fourth order vertices. And we checked, and you can check that for this particular computation that I just described, these fourth order vertices are subleading. They don't do anything. So the fourth order vertex, which you should strictly speaking also include in this computation, is subleading for this particular computation. Therefore, there does not seem to be the need here at the level that we did the computation to add any new intrinsic wormhole arguments or computation of vertex to the theory. Now, we did this at a rather crude level. It would be nice to do it more precisely and maybe compute like a one loop determinant in this wormhole background, and that would give a more precise prediction to compare to. But yeah, that's pretty complicated. You have to compute some one loop determinant in some gravitational background with genus two surfaces and so on. There are some beautiful determinant representations that have been worked out in the math literature, but we didn't try to do the computation. But now here are two predictions that where we don't know the wormhole. So we can do the same computation for CHHH squared, but do it with slightly different diagrams. So here secretly, I drew this little diagram that is the configuration, it's the kinematic configuration that underlies this computation. There's another kinematic configuration that corresponds to the pictures here. These are also, if you want, genus two computations, but now it's in a different corner of the genus two moduli space, where this cartoon with HHH is a good approximation. So you want that in some sense, the temperature in this loop is high, the temperature in this propagator is high, and the temperature in this loop is high, because in those three channels, you want heavy operators to dominate. Whereas in the previous one, you wanted also three propagators to be at high temperature, but that's a different part of the moduli space of genus two Riemann surfaces. Now, in this case, if you repeat exactly the same computation that I did here, you write all these wave contractions. In this case, these fourth order vertices also contribute. But here, something amusing happens, namely, whereas here the fourth order vertex was subleading, here the fourth order vertex is actually dominant. And if you just put in the numbers, you seem to get a prediction that there should be a wormhole that has two genus two boundaries, and whose partition function scales like this. In terms of the central charge C, the lightest non-trivial operator in the theory chi, so it depends on the lightest non-trivial operator in the theory, which is interesting, so it depends on matter content. And this is the structure that you get. So if this computation is reliable, and there is no new weird wormhole information entering, then the prediction is that there should be a new genus two wormhole with this partition function. And this is much larger than there's also a Maldacena Maas type wormhole in this case, but that one has a partition function of order unity, so that's much less than this one. So there is a prediction here that there is a wormhole if you have two genus two surfaces. Its partition function depends on the dimension of a light operator, and that strongly suggests that this wormhole must be supported by a matter field, because otherwise, how could the partition function depend on the dimension of a matter field? So presumably this, if it exists, but it has not been found, but if it exists, it must be a genus two wormhole that is supported by a matter field. And also this combination is only positive if this delta chi is sufficiently light. So if there's a big gap in the spectrum, this wormhole disappears, and you need a sufficiently light field for this thing to be dominant. But that bound on delta chi is kind of interesting. It's a bit like this thing. If you compute what this bound for delta chi is and you manipulate the numbers, it looks a bit like it's some interesting twist field. And we know that some of these twist fields seem to play an interesting role in 3D quantum gravity. If there's a deep connection, I don't know, but in any case, it's an interesting wormhole prediction that you get from just following your nose and doing this analysis. And it would be interesting to see if this thing can be constructed or whether you can prove that it cannot exist. There's an even simpler prediction that in fact follows already from ETH for a wormhole. Which is if you simply take two thermal two-point functions. Because that thermal two-point function, so this is a cartoon representation of a thermal two-point function at high temperature. There's a corresponding OPE expression, CLHHCLHH, and the second two-point function on the torus as well. And these things also have Gaussian statistics. So here also there will be funny wick contractions like so. And that suggests that there should be a wormhole. It could also be an off-shell gravitational computation, but then all bets are off. But it's kind of suggesting that maybe wormhole solutions exist, where you have two torus boundaries and you have two matter fields inserted on either side. And also this one is apparently stabilized by matter, if this is true. Now this is something that in principle one should be able to check. You just turn on the matter field and you see whether you can cook up wormhole solutions of this type with torus boundary. And some initial playing with it did seem to suggest that indeed, if you turn on some matter fields that maybe at order 4, these things start to have the chance of being stabilized. And you precisely need 4 operator insertions, it seems, to get this thing going. So it would be cool to figure this out. And then it would be another wormhole prediction that comes from statistical thinking. And you could, in principle, compute the numbers. And you could compare the numbers to what you get from ETH and see if the numbers agree. So that's another cool computation that you could do.
I have a question.
Yes.
Apparently, we seem to believe that in order to get a stabilized wormhole that doesn't pinch off, you need exotic matter with negative matter, negative energy. You can't construct a wormhole in practice with ordinary matter because it pinches off as you go through.
Yes, that is correct. And so in this particular case, you probably need so these are Euclidean solutions, and I think the rules of the game are not entirely clear. But I think that this solution, if it exists, it will require you to take a complex trajectory in field space, not a real trajectory in field space. Because as you say, if you take a real trajectory in field space, there is like just a positive energy theorem and that precludes this thing from being stabilized. However, we know examples where things where, like certain complex contours in field space make sense in ADS-CFT. And this could be an example of such a configuration, but I don't know the rules of the game precisely. But this thing, if it exists, it will require a complex contour in field space. And that evades that no-go theorem that you referred.
That's it. There's no known traversable wormhole solution.
No. Well, this is all Euclidean. This is all a purely Euclidean computation.
Yeah, but we live in Minkowski space-times.
No, it's all Euclidean. So the notion of the statement that matter fields tend to not stabilize the wormhole still applies even in Euclidean signature.
Yeah.
So you can use negative curved slices. That's right. That's precisely this genus 2 wormhole is an example of that. So if you have negative curvature, you do have classical wormholes of that type. That's correct. Yes. Here we are in this borderline. So this is flat slicings. It's kind of like the borderline case. And normally these things would just pinch off. So you need to open it up slightly and you need like some negative pressure. And for that, you probably need a complex field. So it's an interesting question. Whether these complexified solutions exist, they would be generalizations of things that are called axionic wormholes in the literature. All these axionic wormholes, I think, also secretly use some complex axion field. And then they excuse that by saying that there's an ambiguity in wick rotating axions to Euclidean signature, but I'm not sure. I'm not really buying that, I think. But it could still simply be a complex solution that contributes to the path integral. Complex solutions that have a well-defined perturbation theory around them may well contribute. All right, I'm reaching an hour, so I should start wrapping up. So I should mention, let me briefly mention this without saying much in detail. I think there's a really other interesting line of thought to pursue here. Because so far I've discussed operator statistics, but there's also statistics in the spectrum of the theory, like in the spectral form factor that some of you may know. And it's unclear right now, I think, what is the right statistical framework that captures all these features, both the operator statistics and the spectral statistics. And so one idea to try to come up with some formalism that generalizes standard statistical physics, and that might capture all these features, but it's just a conjecture or speculation, if you wish, is that what you should do is you should sort of generalize standard statistical physics to think about probability distributions on spaces of density matrices. It seems hard to come up with a statistical framework that is consistent with all the information that I described, including statistical correlations and these OPE correlations. It seems very difficult to come up with anything that has the flavor of statistical physics that does not have this feature. You could say that this measure is a version of this order averaging, but for now, this is just a statistical physics description of the system. And one way, well, I've been thinking quite a bit whether there's like a deeper reason why in a quantum gravity theory, this is a natural structure to appear, and I don't have a very compelling answer. You could imagine that if you have hidden superselection sectors, and maybe those discussions about baby universes and alpha vacua, blah, 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 maybe they're related to that, but I don't know, have nothing precise to say. But maybe if you have a theory with hidden superselection sectors, this could be the type of structure that appears where somehow the mu of rho is some probability distribution of the superselection parameter. But I don't have a sharp intuition for why, except that this is something that has the potential to reproduce all the features that we see. I don't have a very precise argument why this, or compelling argument why in quantum gravity this would be the ultimate description. Nevertheless, it's fun to just take this thought and now to pretend you're Boltzmann and to again ask simple Boltzmann type questions. So you could ask like, well, suppose I give you some low energy information, for example, the expectation value of the energy. What is then the probability distribution density matrices, which has the largest uncertainty consistent with your measurement? It's basically a philosophical principle of statistical physics is that you fix some information and then you look for the thing with the largest uncertainty or the largest entropy that's compatible with your low energy information. And you can ask whether that generalizes here. And I don't know, again, you have to then ask what does uncertainty mean here? Like for a single density matrix, you might think it is the von Neumann entropy. But if you have an ensemble of density matrices, what exactly should you take here? But you can make a naive attempt and just see what you get if you just are very simple. So if you do standard statistical physics, just very briefly, I'm almost done. What you do is you say, well, here's the entropy of my state. I'm taking a Lagrange multiplier that fixes the expectation value of the Hamiltonian to be my energy. So that's my low energy input. So I'm fixing the energy. But then I'm going to look for the state rho that has the largest entropy. That's the thing with that's the most uncertain object that's still consistent with my low energy measurement. And it's a straightforward little exercise that if you do that computation here, you get a finite temperature partition function. So there is a philosophical interpretation of the standard canonical partition function. It's the thing with the maximal entropy, but the right expectation value for the energy. And you can try to redo the same computation for this measure on the space of density matrices. For that, you need to generalize von Neumann entropy. And the most obvious generalization, because it's a combination of classical statistics and quantum statistics, is to use a combination of quantum entropy and classical entropy, which is Shannon information. And if you then grind away, so it's kind of naive, you get a probability distribution on the space of density matrices, which is proportional to E to minus the relative entropy between the state rho and the thermal state rho beta. So that could be an interesting generalization of statistical physics. And if you play a few games with this naive ansatz, then you find some interesting features, because now density matrices fluctuate. You can estimate the size of fluctuations. You can see even that fluctuations scale like E minus S over 2, which is very similar to what you see in ETH, based on this minimum assumption. There's almost no input here. And you also get a feature that all these statistical approaches have, which is approximate unitary invariance in microeconomical energy bands. So there are some appealing features. Unfortunately, if you dig a bit deeper, this turns out to not be such a great ansatz, and apparently you need to refine it further. It's not entirely clear what the precise refinement must be in order to make it work. But this is a little bit too naive, this thing. This allows your rows to fluctuate too wildly in some sense, if you look a bit deeper. Although these initial computations look very promising, and we're trying to figure out how you can improve on this while still having minimal input and while getting all the desired features that you see in these statistical approaches to quantum gravity. Maybe the right question to ask is like, what is the analog of the canonical ensemble if you don't have a single density matrix, but the probability distribution on the space of density matrix? What is the analog of the canonical ensemble? That is maybe the question that we're asking. If you know the precise answer to the question, then we might have a nice statistical framework that allows us to properly describe all the features that I described above. So maybe the final message is that this is the direction we should be exploring more in order to come up with like the right way to think about low energy semi-classical gravity. And I'll skip a few other loose comments and conclude. So I'm just repeating a few questions that they asked. So, you know, can we find these new wormholes that were predicted in this way? Is this thing that I mentioned at the end the right statistical framework, or is there another framework that's more appropriate? Some of the methods I use to get information of these heavy open e-coefficients are very bootstrappy. In fact, many bootstrap results give you so-called sum rules, and many sum rules are statistical information about high energy parts of the spectrum. Because typically a sum rule involves a sum, and that's why it's called a sum rule. It's a sum over the high energy spectrum multiplied by all kinds of functions. But they still give you statistical information, and it would be nice to combine all the insight from all these bootstrap approaches and some rules with this particular way of thinking. I think it's a very interesting question whether single-sided information is enough, and whether wormholes follow from that, or whether wormholes give you genuine new information. I think that might be an interesting statement about gravity. I don't know how to answer that except by exploring these examples. I don't know, have an a priori intuition for this. And you can ask whether there are more deep lessons about chaotic systems in nature. Like, are what we are seeing here, is this a more universal description of chaotic systems? So have we learned anything? Should we just live with the... So if the entire universe has this huge, untractable chaotic sector, then we, how should we view even cosmology? Is there any deep lesson for nature here? And the last statement that I did not emphasize very much, that is the statement that semi-classical gravity is averaging agnostic. Because you get statistical results even in the single theory. In a single theory, however, they're approximate, and in an average theory, they're exact. But from the point of view of semi-classical gravity, you cannot distinguish between the two. Because semi-classical gravity has only access to coarse-grained quantities. And at the coarse-grained level, an exact statistical distribution and a coarse-grained statistical distribution are indistinguishable. And that's why semi-classical gravity is agnostic of whether or not the UV theory is averaged or not. if you wanted to really figure out whether the UV theory is averaged or not, you have to go beyond this Hamming classical approximation and add more ingredients to it. And then eventually you might have enough information to resolve this question. It's also possible that no matter how much information you add to the semi-classical theory, you're just making your statistics more exact. But there's always a little averaging room left because you always have some coarse graining left as long as you do gravitational computations. You'll never solve the theory exactly. There's also some averaging involved. So I'm not sure that in an actual physics example, we would ever be able to truly claim that we have resolved whether the UV theory is averaged or not. We can just put bounds on the amount of averaging. So there's some certain averaging agnosticism in gravity. With that ridiculous sentence, I'd like to end, and thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much for the very interesting talk. Are there more questions for Jan?
Question.
Please go ahead.
Thank you for your interesting talk. I hope you don't mind me asking a general practical physics question. You've been doing semi-classical quantum gravity as opposed to attempting to quantize the left-hand side of Einstein's field equations, the geometry. So from a practical point of view, there are no laboratory quantum gravity experimental data. We anticipate that quantum gravity becomes observable at the Planck energy, 10 to the 19 GeV. And whether we'll ever get an accelerator at 10 to the 19 GeV is questionable. As far as black holes are concerned, unless you volunteer to take a spaceship and go inside a black hole, you're always an external observer. So you will never know what goes on inside a black hole experimentally. So how do we check these quantum gravity predictions that you've made? How can we check them? Physics, experimental physics. Ultimately, we decide in physics what's true in nature by doing experimental testing. How can you do that in this case?
Right. That's obviously a very important question. And the conclusion, there might be a negative conclusion to all of this, is that it is just completely hopeless to ever imagine testing really honest quantum gravity. You might be able to maybe test whether a graviton is actually a quantum object or not. So there's these tabletop approaches where they try to see if they can see that gravity is quantum to begin with. But I don't think that's an honest test of quantum gravity. And it's very interesting, but maybe the conclusion is that we should just not try to actually, it might be hopeless. There might not be an observable signature at all. I don't see from this way of thinking about the problem, there does not seem to be a very clear handle on getting experimental information that would tell us something useful about quantum gravity at this point.
As far as detecting gravitons is concerned, there are these important papers by Freeman Dyson. If you try to construct the detector for gravitons, it'll collapse into a black hole before you can ever detect a graviton, et cetera.
So you can ask, so if you would measure an individual graviton, then you would have established a part of the quantum nature of gravity, so that would be very nice. But these other types of questions about quantum gravity are much more complicated to think about also from an experimental point of view. And unless we are missing some obvious feature, it seems pretty difficult. It's a bit like having only hydrodynamics and if you only have hydrodynamics, how will you learn about molecules? And You can ask whether any of those measurements that have historically been used to see the individual molecules have a counterpart in gravity. And I think if you do the exercise, you don't. Because, yeah, as you say, you need to go to the Planck scale. And unless we, yeah, invent something new, or unless there is a feature of quantum gravity in cosmology that we don't understand, like some people have argued that in cosmology, there is some version of UVIR mixing that maybe leads to interesting experimental, but I don't see any evidence for it. So I don't see from the perspective presented in this seminar, I don't see any new avenue into measuring any interesting feature of quantum gravity beyond these sort of quantum mechanics, graviton type ideas. That's my honest answer at this point.
I just quickly comment that we've been publishing papers on quantum gravity since over 100 years. The Russian physicist Bronstein was one of the first to attempt quantizing gravity around 1932. And we have to look at what we've accomplished. We have a lot of different quantum gravity theories, which often get into internecine disputes with one another. But we have to be able to distinguish experimentally which quantum gravity is correct. I don't see how that's possible.
That's difficult. In some sense, this particular perspective, in some sense, seems to suggest that quantum gravity is a very clever theory that manages to agree with classical gravity in an unreasonable way, almost. So it is hiding its quantum features as well as possibly could be expected from any quantum theory. Of course, it depends on what kind of there could be different. Again, we can have a long debate about different approaches to quantum gravity and what they teach us and so on. I try to make this connection with generic chaotic systems with a chaotic spectrum, and from this AGS-CFT exercise, that seems to capture some features of gravity in the AGS-CFT context, if you want to be very precise, that seem to be fairly robust, compatible with many things that we can know and compute. And if true, the conclusion would be that it is incredibly difficult to measure any sort of quantum gravity effect ever.
By the way, Einstein was always opposed to quantizing gravity.
Okay, thank you both for the comments. Maybe there are more people that they want to ask questions.
Yeah, I guess I have like at least one question. Could you just say a few more words about what exactly goes wrong in this theory of ensemble of density matrices in terms of like fluctuations? I guess
it's basically in this very simple relative entropy model, it turns out that the off-diagonal components, where say one index of the density matrix is the ground state and the other index is a highly excited state, and those things just don't decay fast enough. So there's this huge floppy off-diagonal piece that is very far away from the diagonal, and that fluctuates way too much, and that makes many computations uncontrollable. So there needs to be something extra in the game that puts a penalty on that.
I see.
What may also be true is that if you just do naive perturbation theory, that maybe that's not a very good way to set up the computation, because it's not clear that, you're doing perturbation theory for density matrix, but it's an object that has trace one and should be positive definite, that it's not a linear space. So you have to be quite careful how you set up perturbation theory. And you can do different computation where you write your density matrix as a unitary matrix times like a U lambda U dagger, where lambda is diagonal, and then you integrate out the unitaries first. That turns out to be an exactly doable integral, and then you get just an eigenvalue computation that seems to be more controllable. But still, just this E minus S by itself seems to still be problematic. So it's a spottiness. And in another more abstract setting that we were discussing with Igal Arav and Sierra Chapman, we also saw that it almost looks like a second parameter is needed. So it's not clear that there is an analog to the canonical ensemble where the only input is just is the temperature. Maybe another input parameter is needed. And I'm not sure what that would be. So maybe that's the answer.
As in like another input parameter, like a chemical potential for like some other expectation value or?
Yeah, it's not so clear, but whether it's like an obvious natural candidate. Yeah, or maybe we should come up with some quantity that bounds these annoying fluctuations. Mm. Put the parameter in front of there. Maybe one just, it's also possible that something more silly, like maybe you can insert like the average level spacing at the energy that you input. Maybe so you steer it a bit more into the chaotic theory or so. It's not entirely clear what is the most successful formula. Yeah.
Cool. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Are there more questions?
If no one else has one, then I would ask a last one. Maybe.
Yeah.
And that would just be about this question about whether signal-sided information is enough. I mean, naively, I would have said, well, obviously not, because at least you need to assume that there's some ensemble averaging to be done if you want to have wormholes. But then, I guess then the question sort of becomes, if it's reasonable to choose this ensemble averaging sort of completely independent of the one-sided information, so if the measure of your ensemble sort of has to do with your OPE statistics or whatever. Do you have like a concrete reason to believe that should be the case? I mean, is it like obvious that otherwise one might run into like consistency issues, or maybe you can just comment on this?
So you're asking whether other types of averagings could still be consistent with these wormhole computations? Or?
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess a priori in the wormhole computation for the correlator between operators or like OP coefficients in the two different CFTs, I could in principle choose whatever I want. Now it turns out that if you choose correlations you get from single side information, you seem to produce something which is sort of like overall consistent, nice. But I guess I'm asking, well, what prevents me from choosing some other correlation between like two separate, like a left and a right CFT, because a priori those two things, an ensemble average over theories and an ensemble average within a single, or like OPE statistics within a single theory, like at least I don't see that they have much to do with each other. So,
well, if you let's assume that somehow there is some notion of ensemble averaging going on. Then you still need that the ensemble, if you want crossing symmetry for, let's assume we ensemble average only over strict seasons. If you allow yourself to also average over non-CFTs, then the discussion becomes also interesting. But then you should be able to detect violations of modular invariance and those types of things. And that's really getting to be quite complicated. I think it's pretty hard to cook up something that, because AGS CFT has a modular invariance built in, even in wormholes. And if you start to average over non-CFTs, you would start to violate modular invariance. And I'm sure we can cook up some computation that would have to be non-zero, but whether any gravitational computation would automatically make it equal to zero. So that seems... So let's average only over CFTs. Now, if you want crossing symmetry to work, so if you have a light operator and it has a particular dimension, that dimension cannot depend too much on this parameter, because then you would detect immediately at low energies that you have some average theory. Because you would have some statistical distribution. Then even a two-point function would be like an integral over dj of 1 over x minus y to the power delta. The delta would depend on j. So it would be a weird two-point function. the short distance singularity would be strange. I think there would be low energy indications that, that something weird is happening. So your low energy operators need to be fairly sharply defined. And then you can just ask about crossing. Now, if you do an ensemble average over theories that are all CFTs, then in each instance crossing holds. So in the average theory, crossing must also hold exactly. Then the estimate I gave for the square of the OPE coefficients goes through because I just use crossing. And that means that in that average theory, the statistical estimates I'm making, they're based on single-sided information and they only use crossing and modular invariance. So in any average theory that has sort of sharply defined objects, the averages must be similar to what I get from the statistical analysis. If they're very different, I am violating conformal invariance or crossing symmetry. So that puts very strong limits on the types of average theories.
Okay, yeah, thanks. I think I understand the logic now.
Yeah. Now, if you have a low energy theory like Chern-Simons theory that has basically very few observables, then obviously it's a different discussion because there's no light operator. So the only thing left is like modular invariance. And then there might be, other rules of the game. So I think Alex Maloney had this conjecture that pure 3D gravity is just the average over all CFTs, for example. Well, maybe. But clearly there's no light interesting correlator to compute. You only have partition functions in this case. I'm still not sure in that case how you would... And then this picture of OPE coefficients might not even be a very good notion because you keep in mind that there is some spectrum in the theory, and if there's not even a spectrum that's well defined or it's all over the place, then the spectral uncertainty and the OPE coefficient uncertainty, they start to mingle, and I'm not sure what's happening then. But at a more minimal level, I think it's hard to see how this can be consistent in an average theory that does not happen to agree precisely with the computations that I was doing.
Okay, thank you. Thanks again for the very nice talk and interesting discussion.